one of the joys of coming to New York is that I get to see so many good old friends. One of them is the closest thing I know to a musical comedy star, Tony nominee Brad Oscar, for his role in The Producers. And what I think is so great, you're living the dream. Because when we were at Boston University together, I was a grad student, you were an undergraduate student, you wanted to be on Broadway in musicals, and by God, that's what you are doing.
How
did you do that?
How did I do it?
I want all of our listeners to be able to copy what you've done.
I worked with a certain grad director at Boston University named Austin Titchener.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, whatever it is, wherever you are. Thanks for subscribing, streaming, or downloading and listening to us on your computer or MP3 player. I'm Austin Titchener, one third of the Reduced Shakespeare Company, and you're listening to this week's Reduced Shakespeare Company podcast number 271, Broadway's Brad Oscar. A new TV show premiered here in the States last week called Smash, a scripted one-hour drama that goes behind the scenes at the making of a Broadway musical. That is all the excuse I needed to share with you this conversation I've been holding on to since last November when I met my old friend Brad Oscar at famed Broadway eatery Joe Allen after his performance in the musical of The Addams Family. Brad was nominated for a Tony Award for his performance as Nazi playwright Franz Liebkind in the Mel Brooks musical The Producers, and since then has gone on to be sort of Mr. Reliable in a variety of musicals on Broadway and around the country. We talked about all of that, but first, Brad tried to answer my incredibly impertinent opening question.
You know, I don't know how I did it, except that I have always loved it. And
we've always loved musicals.
Yeah.
And this was one thing we bonded over when we were at school.
Yeah. So, you know, but then I went to BU, actually, to not do musicals for a couple of years, because we didn't really do musicals at BU. And so, you know. But anyway, I think that it's very random what happens in this business, as we know. And and I was, you know, as far as time and place goes, when the producers came along, you know, that was a really fortuitous thing for me and has enabled me, I think, to keep working in a way that I am living the dream in that respect. I really am. And still, there are nights, especially those nights when you're tired, especially those nights when, you know, 8 shows a week is, as you know, it's not an easy thing sometimes. So, yeah, whenever I'm really at that point where I feel like I'm going to detach or I'm going to, not really give it my heart and soul, I remember when I was sitting out there as a, you know, whatever, 13-year-old, 15-year-old, my parents would bring us up from D.C. to see shows, and it was fantasy land to me. It was the be-all, end-all. And so, I never want to forget that, because that's, you know, that's what keeps me on
target. But was the Producers was not your first Broadway show, was it?
What?
The Producers.
Oh, no. I mean, yeah, I was fortunate in that, I moved to the city after BU and spent a couple years waiting tables and auditioning, and then randomly got my first Broadway show, which was Aspects of Love as a swing, you know, covering. Uh-huh. And and then did Forbidden Broadway for a little while, which was fun and, you know, very much like what you do. And
very playing off your strengths, because not only are you a good actor, you're a fantastic comedian and a good singer.
Well, and for that show too, it was great to have an appreciation of musical theater, because that's what you're sending up. So, yes, and thank you very much. Yes. And then Jekyll and Hyde came along. I randomly met Frank Wildhorn at some point and was on a concept album, and they said, you want to do the show? And then the next thing I knew, I was doing Jekyll and Hyde, and that turned into a 4-year run despite what the critics and press had to say about it. I was very grateful in that I was working, supporting myself as an actor for that sort of decade. But then the Producers came along, and when I said, what that changed was, I look at our business as concentric circles, and you know, we want to get to that bullseye, whatever that might be. The Producers enabled me to get a little closer in that people knew then who I was. And I mean people in this business. Because outside of our little village of Anatevka, here in New York, you know, Broadway people aren't known far and wide. But in, so in this little land right here, when it comes to casting directors and people who make the choices and cast these Broadway shows, sure, the Producers enabled them to know who I was in that respect. And so I get to go in and audition for things. I get to be brought in or whatever, and occasionally get offered something without even having to audition, which is, you know, ridiculous.
The best.
Oh my God, it's great.
Well, and yes, and in this little village of Anatevka where we are, yes, maybe your fame doesn't, you know, isn't global, but yet here we are sitting at your table at Joe Allen's.
And my table. If you spent the money that I've spent at Joe Allen, you could have a table too.
We're trading on your celebrity. What, you say you went to BU as an undergraduate actor to get your BFA.
Yes.
Did you go there specifically because it did not have a musical theater program? I mean, did it give you things that you hadn't had previous?
Yes, and that's why, I mean, I auditioned for Carnegie Mellon, which had a full-on musical theater program, and did not get in, because, you know, I think you had to be more of a triple threat or whatever, and blah, blah, blah.
Right. And are you not a dancer? Is that the third part of your...
Yeah, that would be the triple part of the triple threat.
Right.
Yes,
okay.
Exactly. The singing, acting, and dancing. So when BU... and I just for a couple other places. I think I got into NYU as well at the time, but I didn't want to come right to New York. You know, I'd been up, you know, going to the theater and visiting the city, but I thought, you know what, I want to spend these 4 years training, not being constantly pulled by the allure of whether it was going to be auditioning or just, you know, I knew that I was going to live here. So I thought, you know what, let's spend 4 years somewhere else. And Boston is, you know, hardly rural, hardly the sticks.
Well, I remember we would drive down and we would see shows. We saw Sunday in the Park in previews. Yeah.
We did indeed. But yeah, I thought that it would be nice to also have 4 years of some good classical training to, you know, do all that stuff, which we did, and to be able to explore all that as opposed to going to a musical theater school and doing more of what, you know, I had been doing since I was, whatever, 12, 13-ish.
But isn't that sort of the mark of, I don't know what it's a mark of, being an artist or whatever, but you wanted to, there were the things you knew, wanted to go find out things about you didn't know.
Right, exactly, exactly. And I could go home during the summer and do stuff, and, you know, I kept up my singing lessons. I actually took voice lessons through the opera department at BU.
Oh, interesting. I don't even think I even knew that.
Yeah, which was its own thing. Not that I was singing opera, but I was working with teachers that taught and in a system that, you know, trained singers in a certain way, and that was pretty cool, too.
Well, and developing and keeping the instrument strong,
exactly.
As they say.
Yeah. Keeping the chops, yes.
Keeping the chops up.
Yes.
What?
Yes.
What about, all right, so you've been, so since the producers, and as you say, that has led to some other gigs. Right,
yes.
Now you're currently playing Uncle Fester, and I haven't even seen the performance, but I'm looking at you now with your shaved head, and I've seen your picture on the poster. You are Uncle Fester to the core.
I'm having a ball. It's a very sweet role.
Oh, that's
a lot of fun.
And what do you have to do to maintain your instrument as a musical theater performer in New York when you're actually working? Or do you? Is the show itself enough?
Do I take voice lessons or keep up with that? You know, no, not as a rule. No, because the show, yes, exactly. I'm using my voice. And again, I've had great teachers, so I feel like I have a pretty good technique, and my voice pretty much serves me very well, except when you get sick or something like that happens. Yeah. But, you know, it depends on the role. Of course, when I was doing the producers, when I eventually took over Max and was playing Max, I mean, that was my life. To get through that show 8 times a week, you know, that was it.
That's all you did, yes.
Yeah, I mean, exactly. And I wouldn't go out at night, certainly like this, or have cocktails after a show, because I couldn't. But Fester's a little more manageable in that respect. It's all about, you know, doing the show 8 times a week. But
yeah. Well, and how much of it is about doing the show 8 times a week, but even in the producers, but then I see you, for instance, running the gauntlet of the fans at the stage door at the Addams Family, and you're so good with the fans. What is it like to take over? Nathan Lane did such a huge job of making Max Bialystok such a ginormous part, and now suddenly you're playing it.
Right.
What was that like?
Right.
I mean, is that kind of mind-blowing for a kid who this is what I always wanted to do?
Yes, no question. It was totally. I mean, you know, I started as the understudy, so I would go on that first year when Nathan was out, and I would go on opposite Matthew Broderick, who was still star. So, you know, in my mind, I said, okay, look, they're still getting one star for their buck. You know, I mean, it was the biggest thing in town. So I knew that people were disappointed, and I knew that there was a sense of, you know, obviously huge disappointment that they weren't going to see Nathan. You know, right. A Tony-winning performance, an amazing, extraordinary performance, of course, that informed, you know, a lot of what I did, especially that first year, of course. But, you know, I just kept telling myself, look, my job tonight is to play Max. My job is to fill the shell of what has been created, not to go out there and mimic or impersonate him. Right. But, of course, a lot of what I did was based on, you know, what he did, his readings, his timing. Why are you going to futz with a good thing? I mean, that was the definitive, you know, in many ways.
And you don't want to throw off Matthew, who's expecting a certain thing.
Yes, because your job as an understudy, exactly, is to serve, to serve the piece, but also to take into account your other actors on stage who do the same thing 8 times a week and are very married to what that is, even though it is live theater and things change up every night, and everyone's good with that. But there is a certain responsibility that you have as an understudy that is very different than the responsibility you have as an actor originating the role or whatever. Now, once I took over the role, and it was mine 8 times a week, and I then was working with other Leos, and I was, you know, and I worked with, I counted once, I did the show with over 18 different Leos over my 1,400 to 1,500 performances as Max Bialystok.
Wow, I saw you with Steven Weber.
Exactly, who was really my first Leo as far as my one-on-one Leo.
Yeah.
But once I took over the role, then I could start to make it more my own, and it gradually did, and then I could, the ghost of Nathan in my ear and in my head would dissipate a little, because again, it was such a, you know, definitive, extraordinary performance.
Yeah.
I guess I should stop saying definitive, because it's really doing myself a great disservice to those out there who perhaps saw me and preferred mine. No, but you know what I mean.
And that old hack Zero Mostel was not bad either.
Yeah, right. Yeah, well, then there's that. Exactly.
Hi, this is Peter Finch with KGO Radio in San Francisco, and you're listening to the Reduced Shakespeare Company podcast.
Where can you RSC the RSC? This winter, spring, and summer of 2012, you'll be able to RSC us in 34 cities in the U.S. and the U.K. Cities like Fairfield, Connecticut, Stowe, Vermont, Reston, Virginia, New Bremen, and New Philadelphia, Ohio, Eau Claire, Wisconsin, Waverly, Iowa, Tacoma, and Edmonds, Washington, Sonoma, and Santa Rosa, California, Oklahoma City, Oklahoma in May, and then we head over to the UK, to York, Buxton, Exeter, Newbury, Nottingham, Truro, Poole, Tunbridge Wells, Canterbury, Leamington Spa, Derby, Hereford, Rhyl, Barnsley, Salford, Lichfield, Basingstoke, Crawley, Bedford, Tewkesbury, and London. As always, the very best way to stay up to date about all of our worldwide performance dates is to sign up for the Reduced Reader, our email newsletter. Go to ReducedShakespeare.com and click on the link to subscribe and check out our touring page for specific box office venue and ticket information.
In talking about that role, I've completely buried the lead, which is that you originated the role of the of the musical version of Franz Liebkin, the Nazi playwright, played by Kenneth Mars in the movie. What was that like, creating the role, singing those Mel Brooks' songs for the first time? And how much or how little of Kenneth Mars' performance did you use from the movie?
You know, it all, I guess it sort of all went into the blender, because I just took from that and took from obviously what was on the page and the direction that we were given, and these characters are larger than life, certainly Franz of them, they're all Roger Dubree, Ulla, they're all, you know, sort of archetypes.
They're very subtle.
Yes, exactly. yes, Chekhovian, one might say, and they're malaise. But you have to sort of, you know, you have to turn it up to 10, and you have to ideally fill it. There has to be truth, there has to be believability, or it's just a cartoon.
Right.
But that was a challenge, indeed, to trust myself as an actor to bring it up to that level and believe it and not worry about their judgments or whatever, and know that I was going to be guided by, you know, our director, Susan Stroman, and certainly by Mel Brooks himself, you know, who was in the room the whole time.
Well, and did you grow up watching his movies like I did?
Of course. And exactly. And I did feel like, you know what, I know this humor. I understand these rhythms, you know. Yeah. And the more I did the show over the years, and the more people that I worked with in the show and saw do the show, the more I realized that, you know, there it is a style. It is that kind of comedy.
Yeah.
You know, there are rhythms, and it's very important to sort of understand that and be able to facilitate in a way. And so, yeah.
Well, and now you're playing Uncle Fester in Adam's Family, which is a show that the audiences are loving. The critics did not care for. You are the Uncle Fester. You've replaced somebody, but are you able to make it your own?
Right. Well, again, there's another like complicated situation, right? Because you're playing this iconic figure that most people know from the TV show, certainly, as opposed to just the cartoons or whatever, or the films, I guess. You know, I always forget Christopher Lloyd. Actually, I don't. That's not where my mind
goes.
That's
right. That's funny. I don't think of him either. You're
right. Exactly. Exactly. So again, it's sort of filling a shell. It's filling my take on who he is based on what Jackie Coogan created, and certainly then what Kevin Chamberlain, who originated the role, you know, what he did. Because again, I just think it's important to respect that. I think some actors are afraid to, God forbid, you steal or sound like you know. And sure, does it bother me? Did it bother me when people were like, oh, he's just imitating Nathan Lane? Of course it bothered me. I mean, I wasn't imitating Nathan Lane. Right. If it came, you know, if it sounded or felt, well, it's because of
That's the role. Also, you're playing the role.
Yeah, to an extent, exactly.
Yeah.
So with Fester, it's a similar sort of trap in a way, but by the same time, you know, that curtain goes up, they see the family, the response from the audience is so thrilling. To get applause the minute the curtain opens, you know, it's such a lovely thing. So they meet us halfway, and as an actor, it's a lovely thing to know that that audience, a lot of the audience, knows who we are, knows who these characters are. So all we need to do them justice, we need to make this truth and make it believable and tell this story with the Addams Family. But it's a lovely thing to have an audience sort of on board with you right away, you know. We don't have to sort of win them over in that respect.
And be able to snap your fingers in rhythm.
Yes, exactly. Of course, as a white guy. Yes.
But then in addition to your work on Broadway, you have, you know, you've been able to be a musical comedy star in other parts of the world. You played the devil, right? In Damn Yankees, down in D.C., your hometown boy.
Yeah.
And then you played Barnum down in Florida.
Yeah.
I mean, these are not... Yeah. Did you think that these were kinds of roles that you thought growing up you could play someday? Or were they kind of lovely and out of the blue?
Some were lovely and out of the blue. Certainly Barnum was lovely and out of the blue, because having seen that original production with Jim Dale, who walked a tightrope and bounced on a trampoline and did all these amazing physical things, as well as, you know, giving a lovely performance. But that's not, you know, that's not necessarily in the script or part of the text. So, you know, Barnum could be, you know, I mean, the real Barnum did not walk a tightrope.
Right.
So I was very excited to get to do a show like that I always had a fondness for, and I love the score. I got to play the MC in Cabaret.
Oh, my gosh. Oh, wow.
Also at Arena Stage, which was another role that I never would have even thought about doing based on other interpretations that I've seen and based on my idea of what that guy is, again, based on what I've seen. But when Molly Smith, the artistic director, who I had done Damn Yankees the previous year, and she said, would you be interested in doing this role? And I said, well, I think so, but can you tell me why you want me to do this role? Because I'm interested, you know, because again, it had never been in my consciousness. You know, I mean, I want to play Sweeney Todd. I want to play Al Bann. I would love to do Lacage, you know. There are roles I want to play, but I never thought I wanted to do the MC in Cabaret. And then she told me why, basically, or her idea of what it was going to be and what this production was. And it was thrilling and crazy. And
in those
productions, even though those are not original scripts and these are not roles that you're creating originally,
right.
did you get to create your own interpretation of the roles for these productions?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
And that must have been fabulous.
Yes. See, all these shows were regional.
Right.
I would most likely, I'll never say never, but I'm not going to play the MC in Cabaret in the next Broadway revival. I'm not going to be Barnum in the next Broadway revival.
Right.
You know, Hugh Jackman will be Barnum.
Right.
In the, but so to have the opportunity to go and, you know, and play these roles and explore these roles in a place where you can take the time and where it's not all about the commercial, you know, whether
right.
the show is a success, whether the critics like it or not, you know.
Right. Right.
And that's a lovely thing
yeah.
to be able to work that way and not have to worry
yeah.
about those
well,
things.
Well, but clearly you're doing something right because they keep asking you back.
I guess. I don't know.
And so you're in a hit now. You're in Adam's Family's. How are you already lining things up for the future?
Well, I'm starting to look only because Adam's Family will be closing at the end of the year on December 31st. So my antenna are up. I've had a couple auditions. Nothing's come through yet.
Yeah.
You know, I play the game. I trust at this point because I have been very fortunate and for, you know, a nice chunk of time I've been making my living now doing this. But I would be lying to you if I didn't say that there are times when I'm falling asleep at night and I'm thinking, okay, I'm 47 years old and I'll be unemployed in January. You know, I mean, you know, it's part of the deal. It's just part of the deal. And I trust that, you know, things have gone very well and I've made the connections. And so, you know, I'll just keep it going.
That's it for this week's Reduced Shakespeare Company podcast. Send us your Broadway stories via email to feedback@reducedshakespeare.com. You can also post comments on our website podcast page, and you can post reviews on iTunes. You can interact with other fans on our website and our Reduced Shakespeare Company Facebook fan page. You can also become a subscriber to our YouTube channel or become a twit. Follow us on Twitter @Reduced. You can find easy links to all these social networks at our website, reducedshakespeare.com. Thanks, as always, to webmaster Matt Rippey, Dance Captain Matthew Croak, music by John Weber and Garage Band. Our random fan shout-out this week goes to Perpetual Imagination, one of the many podcast listeners who has left reviews on our iTunes podcast page. No reason. It is just random. Special thanks to Peter Finch from KGO Radio in San Francisco. In honor of the passing of the great Whitney Houston this weekend, I will leave you with our reduced tribute to her iconic movie moment from Completely Hollywood Abridged. And finally, thanks very much to you for listening. I'm Austin Titchener, 271-813th of the Reduced Shakespeare Company. Is a production of the Reduced Shakespeare Company. Reducing expectations since 1981. Go to reducedshakespeare.com for performance dates, actor bios, email newsletters, and so much less.
So much less. So much less. So much less.